From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Vermont author Howard Norman, a three-time winner of National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships and a winner of the Lannan Award for Fiction. His 1987 novel, The Northern Lights, was nominated for a National Book Award, as was his 1994 novel, The Bird Artist. He is also the author of the novels The Museum Guard, The Haunting of L, and Devotion. His books have been translated into 12 languages. Norman teaches in the MFA program at the University of Maryland. He lives in Washington, D.C. and Vermont with his wife and daughter. I've spoken with him twice. In this interview from 2013, we discussed his memoir, I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place, published by Mariner. The production was a cooperative effort with RETN of the Media Factory and is also available to stream online at mediafactory.org. If you click on Watch, you can then search for Howard Norman and find the video of this interview. His memoir begins with a portrait, both harrowing and hilarious, of a Midwestern boy's summer, working in a bookmobile under the shadow of his grifter father and the erotic tutelage of his brother's girlfriend. Howard Norman's life story continues in places as far-flung as the Arctic, where he spends part of a decade as a translator of Inuit tales, including the story of a soapstone carver turned into a goose, whose migration time lament is, "I hate to leave this beautiful place," and in his beloved Point Reyes, California, as a student of birds. Years later, Norman and his wife lend their Washington, D.C. home to a poet and her young son, and a subsequent murder-suicide in the house has a profound effect on them. The New York Times Book Review called the book an unexpectedly arresting memoir. In Norman's book, life's unpredictable strangeness is fashioned into a creative and redemptive story. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Howard Norman. Welcome to Catalyst. Today's show is a cooperative effort between RETN and The Radiator, 105.9 FM in Burlington. I'm Shayla Shapiro, host of a Radiator program called Write the Book. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Howard Norman, whose new memoir is I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Two of Howard Norman's novels, The Northern Lights and The Bird Artist, were nominated for the National Book Award. His other novels include The Museum Guard, The Haunting of L, Devotion, and What is Left the Daughter, about which we spoke on Write the Book in 2010. Howard Norman's books have been translated into 12 languages. He is the recipient of a Lannan Award in Fiction, and he teaches at the University of Maryland. Howard Norman and his wife, the poet Jane Shore, divide their time between Vermont and Washington, D.C. Welcome, Howard. It's such a pleasure.
Good to see you again.
You too. I wanted to start out by talking about the title of your book, yes. I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place, which comes from an Inuit folktale. Mm-hmm. But it's also sort of echoed through the years by people you know and yourself, sort of almost like a little bit of a mantra through the book. And I wondered if you could talk about the title and the folktale and how you came to choose.
Sure. One of the uncanny things about writing this memoir is that I discovered a lot of the themes and preoccupations of my fictional characters in retrospect. And if you applied that perhaps to the title, I think everybody who travels to more than one place or back to a place often feels this sort of preemptive sadness or melancholy when they're going to leave it. I feel that way very much every time I leave Vermont or Northern California, perhaps in particular, Nova Scotia. And so when I was thinking about this book and titling it, I had written a chapter about a folktale I had been translating in the Northwest Territories when I was stationed there, working there. And it involves a man who is a soapstone carver, and a malevolent shaman transforms him into a goose. And he realizes that unless he flies south, he'll die, he'll perish. And so before he leaves, he lets loose this haunting and resonant lament. I hate to leave this beautiful place. I hate to leave this beautiful place. Echoing across the tundra in which the acoustics really can carry things a long ways. And so that seemed the perfect refrain for this whole book, because this book is not just about incidents of arresting strangeness, but it's where you go, what kind of landscapes you go to think those things through, mm-hmm. What Emerson called meditative landscapes. And that's really why I chose that title, because I think it applies both to that folktale and to the way I feel about things.
Okay. Did the title exist before the section of the book titled I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place? Did you know that would be the title of the book?
No.
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 Okay.
I had 8 or 10, 12 titles.
Okay.
Like every book, you write down these titles, you live with them. I think with the exception of one novel, I always came to the title late. Uh-huh. And different writers are different ways.
Yeah.
Okay, with that great. Kind of thing.
Now, as you mentioned, it is also the title of one of your sections of the book. There are 5 sections,
yeah.
Preceded by an introduction. I wonder if you can talk about structuring the book. You write they are overlapping panels of memory and experience.
Yeah.
And I'll just mention the titles of the sections are Advice of the Fatherly Sort, Gray Geese Descending, I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place, Kingfisher Days, and The Healing Powers of the Western Oyster Catcher.
A lot of birds in there,
yeah,
I realize.
You always have a lot of birds, which is great.
Well, I wrote 8 or 10, 11 chapters, uh-huh. And I wanted to write them novelistically, that is to say, with a sense of narrative. Basho, the great haiku master, said, you know, we don't remember things with the same emotions we originally experienced them. So the idea of writing a memoir, for me at least, was to create a kind of immediacy in the way you would a kind of seance, because in a seance, things come back almost fully, but not quite. Mm-hmm. And that interested me a lot. And so I chose these 5 in 2 ways, one because of their intrinsic qualities, but 2 because the other ones didn't fit mm-hmm. somehow. And writing's altruistic. The things that don't work, you have to let go, even if you love the writing. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. So that's really the origin of it. This is a very associational book. Themes are introduced, left for a while, you come back to them. But again, in rereading it once, I think I've only read it once since I finished it, there's no real reason for me to read it.
Well, you know the story.
And I realized certain things showed up that showed up later, or midway through, happened before, and still you're still in that unconscious state mm-hmm. of thinking associationally, mm-hmm. rather than a precise chronological order. I don't know anybody that actually remembers their life in a precise chronological order.
Or the exact words.
Or the exact words. So it's a sense of verisimilitude, of trying to get as close to it as you can.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the book starts out with the section titled Advice of the Fatherly Sort, and yeah. I was wondering if you could read a little bit
of course.
From the book now.
Yeah. On summer evenings in 1964, I used to sit on the basement stairs to read and cool down. This was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. August was particularly steamy, and about 7 o'clock on a Friday, late in the month, I sat there and watched my older brother's girlfriend, Paris Keller. I was named after the capital of France, she said, who was wearing blue jeans, a t-shirt, and sandals, cross her arms, raise off her shirt, and toss it into the clothes dryer. Lavender in color, it had been soaked transparent by rain on her walk to our house. Paris owned a car, but liked to take long walks, too. The t-shirt read, Exist to Kiss You, a declaration that was both existential and, for me, at age 15, almost cruelly erotic. She stood there naked from the waist up. The shirt tumbled alone behind the dryer's glass window. Paris looked over at me a few times. We talked a while. I was all but praying that the shirt needed a second cycle. Paris told me her father had been killed in the Korean War. It was the first conversation I ever wrote down. Typed it Hunt and Peck on an Olivetti manual typewriter. I made a copy on carbon paper, too. I'm looking at the pages now. Remember carbon paper? If you handled a sheet carelessly, you would leave fingerprints on everything you touched, as if you'd broken into your own life. I liked Paris a lot. More about her later. To this day, my father's secret life draws certain difficult associations with an apothecary. In the Midwest in the early 1960s, the word apothecary had not exclusively been replaced by the term drugstore or even pharmacy. In Dykstra's apothecary on Division Street, the proprietor, Peter Dykstra, not only was the pharmacist, but occasionally doubled as the soda jerk. In the summer months, he'd hire a teenager to work the counter, which had three spin-around red leather seats, each elevated on a silver column with a silver plate at the base riveted to the floor. Dykstra's apothecary was stenciled in an arc of bold lettering across the wide front window. One day, the radio said the summer was proving downright tropical. The fighting in Indochina had completed its transition to the Vietnam War. You could order a root beer float, a coffee, a milkshake, a Coca-Cola. That was it. No, you could also get a grilled cheese sandwich. The apothecary carried an Afrikaans language weekly. Mr. Dykstra had been born and raised in Johannesburg. For concocting root beer floats, there was a helmet-headed spigot out of which a pressurized elixir hissed and gurgled into the glasses the size of a small flower vase. That summer's employee was Marceline Vanderhoek, who wore a triangular paper hat bobby pinned atop her pale blonde hair. Her boyfriend, Robert Boxer, a quote, part Negro boy from Otto Hills High School, as Marceline said, had his driver's license and provided home deliveries using Mr. Dykstra's Studebaker. Robert was an All-State guard in basketball. Years later, he became a Rhodes Scholar in art history at Oxford. Later yet, he became a successful painter in Paris and then San Francisco, specializing in portraits. I own a small oil painting of his. It shows two elderly black women sitting in wheelchairs, chatting as if on someone's porch, except the chairs are set out on a dock at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. Trawlers are moored in the background. Robert Boxer frequented the bookmobile where I was employed. The driver, a trained librarian named Penny Oler, would say, "Hello, Robert. I've got a knee-high orange in my chest here for you. You want to look at the art books, of course." Robert would sit in the bookmobile for the duration of the Dykstra's apothecary stop, studying with great concentration books about Picasso, Matisse, Georgia O'Keeffe, and a few other world-famous artists. The art section never had more than 20 books in all. One thing Penny Oler told me was that Peter Dykstra had been ostracized and all but run out of the Dutch Reformed Church for allowing a mixed-race couple in his employ. At the time, that was all I ever heard about this subject. Except when Robert Boxer said, "I love kicking the shit out of East Grand Rapids in basketball. They look up at the scoreboard last 2 minutes, and those Hollanders get crazy, bug-eyed, terrified looks on their faces, all panically, like they just ate a bunch of poisonous tulips. They and us worship a different Jesus, as my Alabama grandmother liked to say." One other thing, Robert Boxer was Peter Dykstra's son. Robert's mother had passed away. But Robert preferred to use his family's name, Boxer. The emotions of it all registered in me, then, in an unlettered way, deep in the nerves. Any real understanding of how the apartheid system in far-flung South Africa was an intensifying element in the racist atmosphere of Grand Rapids came only in retrospect, when in 1977 I was living in Ann Arbor and read that Robert Boxer's older brother, Reginald, had been beaten senseless during a violent protest in Detroit against the murder of the activist Stephen Biko by the South African police. The name of Robert's younger brother, James, is on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C.
Thank you for reading that excerpt.
My pleasure.
The apothecary becomes very important to you as a child because your father used to hang out there.
He did.
Yeah. And you and your father didn't have a relationship, but you used to sort of observe him without his knowledge when he would be going into the... Is that correct? It's more or less?
I would say that that was the relationship.
That was the relationship.
It was a visual, unrequited thing. So it was a double lens, if you will. You know, there was the window of the bookmobile and then this vast window of the apothecary.
And we should say that you got a job in the bookmobile eventually.
I was on the bookmobile. It was my first big job.
So he didn't know you were there.
Nope, he didn't know I was there. But I my mother had been under the impression or felt the need to tell me that he was living in Northern California. Mm-hmm. And so if she actually didn't know, then I had this secret information and didn't feel free to tell her. Mm-hmm. That might have caused pain. Mm-hmm. But if she did know, then I was feeling that pain anyway because my mother felt the need to fabricate a reason for my father's absence. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, like most kids, there were a lot of absent fathers. And I can remember once, my closest friend at the time was named Paul Amundsen, and he told me once that he said, my mother told me that my father was out to find himself. And he found himself at a woman's house in Los Angeles.
That's what the mother said.
That's what the mother says. And when we were kids, if you had one missing parent, for whatever reason, you became a kind of expert at the art of euphemism. Mm-hmm. Because you would say, oh no, my father's employed somewhere else, or a friend of mine whose father was away, oh, he's an actor in Europe. But this was all euphemistic, projection, fantasy, mm-hmm. desire. Nothing new in any of that. It was just my experience.
One thing that you write about in the book, which I found very touching about this kid who you were, and also as a writer, I found it very interesting. You started writing letters to other people's fathers.
I did.
And I thought that was so amazing. You know, you wanted contact with father.
Yeah.
And instead of your own father, with whom you couldn't have contact, you started reaching out to other people's fathers. Although, at the time, you thought it would stay in your dresser drawer. But anyway, I wonder if you can talk about the impetus to write letters.
I think that there are willful themes when you're writing. There are things that are unifying elements that you keep trying to work out. And then later you realize there were other things going on. And one of them is this sort of sense of unrequitedness. And before my mother passed away a number of years ago, she sent me a bunch of notebooks I'd kept, or journals I'd kept in sixth grade. Mm. And I left them around for the longest time. And one day I looked at them and I realized I was quite shocked that they were comprised almost exclusively of marriage proposals. And I had proposed marriage to the teachers, the assistant principal, to a lot of girls, and I had proposed marriage in quite a different tonality to my closest friend, Paul. And I think it was not so much about the idea of a lifelong, you know, coexistence, but just the idea of trying to persuade people that one had good qualities that they might want to pay attention to. Don't pass these up,
yeah,
you know.
It's so interesting that you framed it that way.
Yeah. I never proposed marriage, and I never sent those letters.
Yeah.
So, you know, my mother used to say to me, if you get angry at somebody, write them a letter, but don't send it.
Oh.
And many, many years later, I both understood it and kind of resented it. Because you are basically left with all of that emotion, but you don't get to do anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe 40 years later, writing about it is a way to, you know, organize one's emotions.
And then you put it out in the world.
Put it out in the world. Finally get to send those letters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I wanted to return a little bit to your father. And the way that you write about your father in this section, you write about his failings as a father, but you intersperse this with other stories that were happening at the time. And one of them is the story of a swan that you accidentally trapped and
mm-hmm. and drowned.
It drowned yeah. when you were a boy. I found it very interesting that you interwove these stories. You had such an emotional summer that year, and I wondered, was the motivation structural as a writer, or was it just the coincidence of timing that these two stories needed to be placed side by side?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me at least, it was important to put on exhibit how much can actually happen in a summer. I didn't willfully place all these events in the same proximity on a square on the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Or squares on the calendar. Mm-hmm. These things all happened because lots of things happen to a kid anyway. It's just a matter of constructing memories about them and then choosing later on to write about them. Again, writing in a straight chronological order would have been fraudulent because I didn't remember them that way.
Yeah.
They come in great washes of memory and they set up their own kind of orchestration.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested in a symphonic construction
yeah.
in a chapter rather than just simply going from A to B to C.
Right. Well, along those lines, I did have a question for you about transitions. And it's basically I did observe that, that you don't necessarily go from A to B to C. And I wanted to just read, if I may, a few different opening sentences.
Mm.
So,
thank you.
These are all from the section Gray Geese Descending.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to figure out how you did these transitions because they seem a little bit disparate, these, and I'm not talking about transitions from chapter to chapter, but really paragraphs within
yeah.
a section. So, opening line in a paragraph is, "The next morning, Matilda left before I woke, 2 days earlier than she had originally planned." So this is actually very important, that the paragraph goes on to talk about Matilda, who was your lover, leaving on a trip that eventually we find out would be her last. She mm-hmm. died in an airplane accident. And we know that, actually, when we get to this point, that this is the last time you'll see her. And then the next paragraph starts with the line, "I don't know much about premonition." And then you go on to talk about whether or not you actually foresaw anything foreboding in Matilda's absence, which is interesting and seems sort of connected. The next paragraph begins, "Isidore Savovnik wasn't technically my uncle,"
yeah.
which is just such a, you know, it just takes us like somewhere else completely than we're expecting to go. But it was
yeah.
wonderful because it led into a section about Isidore and your relationship, and his affection for Matilda eventually becomes part of it. And then you bring us back to the active storyline.
Wow, so much is going on there in that question.
Yeah, yeah.
So
but
shall I take a moment to,
yes.
to address this?
Absolutely, I just loved the...
Because what you've said is probably suffices, actually.
But I loved the organic nature of how
yeah.
you move through
I mean, first of all, I think for me represented in that chapter is a lot of listening to and translating of Inuit folktales.
Yeah.
Because Inuit folktales don't follow a sort of Western notion of chronology. They'll have three beginnings, five middles, intimations of various endings. But in aggregate, you get a full story.
Yeah.
So the emotional dimensions are equally as important as the information imparted.
Right.
So now that was conscious. That wasn't an unconscious act. I was really
putting Isidore right where he came.
Wanting to do it that way. But having said that, you know, we aren't stenographers of our own experience. When you're 7, 10, 18, 19, unless you're keeping journals, which I was, but not of this sort, you aren't writing down as things happen. But you can be a stenographer of your own memory, mm-hmm. and just chronicle how things are coming back to you as they're coming back to you. Mm-hmm. That's why in that chapter, the opening lines to paragraphs seem to leap between places. The hope is at the end, the whole thing will be a kind of reading experience that has some immediacy.
Yeah. Yeah. In a very satisfying way, actually.
Well, I hope so. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Yeah.
But it's different. Each chapter is written a little differently.
Uh-huh. Okay.
In this book.
This is a line from the book, and I loved it. So I wondered if you could talk about this outlook. The
sure.
line is, "To my mind, self-deprecation is useless, except when it is used as the first rung on a ladder of self-reckoning." I really enjoyed that. I'm pulling it out of the air. So.
Well, I think about this a lot because, I mean, we all know people for whom self-deprecation is actually a form of self-regard. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm this and I'm that and, oh, I'm a terrible person or I'm a deeply flawed person.
Always bringing the conversation back to...
And it's solipsistic and you want somebody to actually say, no. You're really this or that. And so you want them to redefine you after you've presented a false definition of yourself, but you've done it on purpose. Well, I don't like being around that, and I don't enjoy it. So I think if you say something penetratingly negative, I feel you're obligated to actually figure out if it's true or not. I sometimes joke and say that I have many flaws, but they're my strongest qualities. And in some ways, that paradox I'm much more comfortable with, humor aside, because I think that self-deprecation can be just a way of letting yourself off the hook, mm-hmm. saying, oh, I'm sorry, I'm awful.
Right.
But in these chapters, really, I think, I noticed that I really am trying to be honest about what I think my limitations are.
Right.
And still are. And not for any purpose other than declaring them and trying to be honest.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's sort of the opposite of some memoirs where it's all how great I am or how...
The wonder of me.
The wonder of me and all of my heroic acts. But by saying this, and actually I did pull this out of context and it was relevant to something that was going on in the book at the time, but I thought that it was a nice line to include in the memoir because, it sort of draws attention to these ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about how can you comport yourself with dignity in writing? And I mean, one of the goals here was to try to write a memoir that was largely not about myself, that I could participate in and keep establishing a narrative distance from things. This is how close up I was to that. This is how far away I was for that. And that at least corresponds with the idea of you looking back. I mean, you look back at a certain distance to everything that happened to you, mm-hmm. even if it happens 10 minutes ago.
Right.
Your version of events will change over the years. The deal with this book, though, is that the chapters I chose really contain things that kind of wouldn't leave me alone, mm-hmm. that kept coming back. Mm-hmm. And so, oddly enough, thinking about them was a kind of rehearsal for writing them. Mm-hmm. So I would think about it, and finally sit down to write them. So the actual writing was relatively short in time span, in relationship to how long I'd been thinking about these things.
Does that happen with your fiction as well, where something will kind of keep tapping you on the shoulder for a long time before you start to
sometimes
write about it?
Yeah. Sometimes. And it, other people would say different things about that. For me, this was a different kind of experience than fiction, although it was important for me to apply certain novelistic constructs, organizing principles, structures. But that's different than applying fictional elements. The way you structure a novel can be applied to nonfiction, but you can't lie.
I mentioned a little bit before about Matilda. Your girlfriend who died in a plane crash. She was an artist, and I was very interested to read that at one point in her life, she gave away a series of her work.
Yes, early work.
Yes, to rid herself of, you write, to rid herself of what felt like an obligation, which I thought was interesting. And I wondered if you have ever destroyed creative work for any reason because you felt the need to not have it exist in the world anymore.
Well, let me address the original part first about her, if you don't mind.
No.
Because what she meant, what I think she meant, was that there were certain, if not politically correct, then obligatory themes. She was writing about black culture. She was mixed race. She was writing about black culture in Halifax, her parents' lives. And I think obligatory meant a number of things. Subject matter, but also an inherited sensibility, and thirdly, maybe a kind of homage to her own parents' life. But she had other designs. She wanted to paint landscapes. She was a very urban person. But you know, when I knew her, she was already, you know, far beyond anything I could be in sophistication and experience. She'd been married once.
She was 5 or 6 years older than
you? Yeah, and she was, I don't want to suggest that I looked at her death as metaphorical, that she was already gone in a way, but it was really true. She was, I had her in my life for a very intense, short period of time. But she was on to great things in the world.
Yeah.
And so it was special.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Yeah. As for me, throwing things out?
Yeah.
Of course, every day, crumple up papers. You mean complete works or something?
I remember Woody Allen once said that the best movies he's ever made are the ones he's never made. So to some extent, I wonder if people get rid of their creative work because it just can never measure up to the vision of it. Or for whatever reason, have you
ever
done?
So he didn't say the ones he hasn't made yet.
Right.
Yeah. Because if he said that, then it's a sense of ongoing possibility.
Right.
But it would be, I think, almost coy to suggest that there were things that other people wouldn't get to see that he'd thrown away. I don't have that.
I mean,
I wrote a novel that was pretty awful, that I knew was awful, but and individual pieces of writing, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's see. So you were pretty impetuous as a young man in some cases. Yeah, the auctions I'm thinking about.
Yeah, that impetuousness probably still manifests itself in certain ways.
Okay.
I
should explain that you attended an auction very unexpectedly. You kind of stumbled upon it, and you
threw
ended
up my hand,
raising your hand, and
now fire. Owned this beautiful artwork. Is this picture of a gull by my favorite bird artist, Mark Catesby, but then I owned it.
Right.
And I didn't have a penny to pay for it. So that indebts you in a lot of ways. But It makes you indebted
in a lot
of ways.
It wasn't just a painting that cost $50 either.
No, it was expensive.
So
I'm working on a new novel in which the narrator bids on art for someone else.
Oh.
So it comes back around. Experience, you know. I'm not through with it yet.
Right.
But I'd like to assign this impetuous aspect to somebody other than me.
Yeah. So that's going to be fiction.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of using your work toward your fictional works, after Matilda died, you went through a phase of having seances. You conducted seances
I
in
did,
your apartment.
Yeah. I looked them up in books, it sounds absolutely absurd and comical, if not contrived in a certain way. Mm-hmm. But actually, it was a manifestation of, to my mind at least, a manifestation of, how can you actually look up a way to do something? Because books give you instructions on how to hold seances, except you're not supposed to hold them by yourself. You're
right.
Supposed to have a group.
Right, well, you say,
you
write, I quickly became a charlatan, a purveyor of false encouragement toward myself.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, I think that's accurate.
Yeah, and it reminded me a little bit of The Haunting of Elle.
Yeah.
And I wondered if that experience fed into your writing.
I never
that
thought
novel.
Of that.
Oh, okay.
But there again underscores the fact that in retrospect, you find out things. Now,
that
as
influence.
You say that, that has to be true to some extent.
And I should say The Haunting of Elle is about spirit photography.
Spirit photography. I was very interested in charlatanism, how certain people took advantage of the desire for people to see loved ones.
Mm.
Spirit photography was very popular after World War I and after the Civil War
mm-hmm.
for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
There were vast amounts of people that were desperately wanting to have their loved ones back.
Sure.
And there was a whole almost genre of photography that was very fraudulent and very potent psychologically. And so I suppose you're right. Those things connect up.
Yeah, okay. I loved that you wrote about your study and of the Inuit people and recording their oral histories. And I wondered what drew you to that.
Employment. I know that doesn't strike any kind of
romantic
chord at all. I started working in Canada because there was employment. It certainly had a lot of unforeseen aspects.
Yeah.
And it was difficult. It's difficult to be in remote areas. You're infantilized because you have to learn the languages.
Mm-hmm.
There are racial tensions. There are cultural tensions. But I was very fortunate because I got to work with wonderful people and stories,
mm-hmm.
hundreds and hundreds of folk tales, and met some very unusual people. And one day I was watching Werner Herzog's documentary on people who lived in Antarctica and worked. And I realized later that those people he was filming were people that could only really live there, that part of the world sustained them in a very idiosyncratic and very beautiful and intense way. Those are the type of people I met.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you would say to them, well, don't you want to go down in the cities? Don't you want to see, you know, a Bergman movie? And they would look at you like you were crazy.
Yeah.
This was their fate that they embraced. I wasn't like that. I finally had to leave.
Yeah.
But while I was there, I heard and saw things that were very formative for me,
mm-hmm.
and in my own way.
Mm-hmm. You write about Lucille Amarac?
Lucille Amarac.
Amarac, mm-hmm. a poet.
Yeah.
You talk about her poetry as having crafted informality, which I loved.
Yeah, somewhere between oral and written sounding. I think that she was influenced in her locutions by listening to sermons in church.
Oh.
But the subject matter of her poetry, Lucy's, was very anecdotal, very local, mm-hmm. very personal.
Did her work influence the way you write, do you think?
I should be so lucky. I don't think so. The more I try to be influenced by great things, the more I fail.
I know, so, you can't really push it onto your work.
But I mean, once in a while, I think sometimes sentence structures, long looping sentences followed by short contracted sentences, might come from Inuit storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of enthusiasms would get them in a verbal fugue state for 3 or 4 minutes, and suddenly they would slow down and sort of do choppy words. I was always attracted to that.
Mm-hmm.
So it might have sunk in some systemic level with my thinking about writing.
Well, the other thing that occurs to me is that you came to writing somewhat late, or certainly the writing that you do now.
I had those marriage proposals.
I know.
That was early.
But you published your first novel at 38, is that right?
I was 38.
38.
Yeah.
So it seems that maybe all of this was part of your education.
Yeah, I wonder, I think, you know, it's funny that you say that, because I'm thinking more and more that that may be a generational lens. I don't mean between you and I, but I mean that the idea of some of the pressures on, because I didn't go through writing courses, it was more, mm-hmm. you know, autodidact kind of literary life, that there are a lot of pressures on people to suddenly publish early. I never thought of it.
Mm.
And
yet it was your goal early on? Was it your goal?
Not to write novels.
Oh, okay.
It was only, that was much later, and I actually just simply wanted to write natural history. I mean, really, that's what I thought I would be doing, or wanted to do.
Yeah.
Novels came later, but once they started, I felt, okay, this is really great.
You should pursue this.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And that has a lot to do with Jane, uh-huh. Who was already very established as a poet.
Right, Jane Shore, your
yeah.
wife. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Early in our conversation, you talked about how the title of this book became a refrain within
yeah.
the book. You also have a section in the book titled Kingfisher Days, and in that section you use a refrain, everything I loved most happened most every day.
Yes.
And that becomes a refrain in that section. And so I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about using refrain in a creative work, now that we've talked about two refrains in this book.
In that chapter, which is a chapter about Vermont,
uh-huh.
There's a poet named Robert Kelly, and he had a poem in which he used that line, everything I love most happens every day. And I thought, I feel a slight variation on that,
mm-hmm.
that when I'm in Vermont, everything I love most happens every day, almost, because there are also untoward things that happen.
Like you have to dig a well.
And you have to dig a well, or your car spins off the road, or whatever it is, a friend's upset, or, you know, quotidian life.
Mm-hmm.
But the little daily cadences that I find in my farmhouse are very deeply sustaining and full of humor
mm-hmm.
and unpredictability. And so that refrain was very willful in that chapter. I wanted to make sure that every few pages I said it, almost to reassure myself,
oh, sure, yeah.
I think,
that it was
that
true.
It was true. Because, you know, you're also locatable in a place.
Right.
And so when you establish a home like that, that's where sometimes people or things, untoward elements of life find you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a paranoia, it's just your address.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd rather be in that farmhouse when perhaps disquieting things happen than anywhere else. It's a safety net,
mm-hmm.
kind of.
Yeah. Well, that sort of leads us naturally into another question I have for you. Another section of the book is largely devoted to an event that took place in the home that you and Jane Shore used to own in Maryland, a very tragic event. in which a woman who was house sitting for you, who was a poet and a mother, and she was living there with her young son, and she was, unbeknownst to you, going through a very difficult time, a depression. She was bipolar. And she murdered her son and committed suicide in your home. You were in Vermont at the time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The house was in northwest part of Washington.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just such a terribly sad story on so many levels. But the sadness that this brought into your family, the unwelcome attention, the extraordinary amount of focus that you were, you know, suddenly in the limelight for this horrible thing, is very clear in your writing about it in the chapter that you dedicate to this. And I was wondering if you could talk, in terms as general or specific as you like, about what it's like to have another person's story become your own story without your volition, you know?
Yes. Jane organized her thoughts about this much earlier than I was able to, in several poems. And in one of those poems, she writes, and I'm paraphrasing, it's their story, not ours. And she keeps saying that back and forth because someone who she trusts and knows said, this was imposed upon you, this is visited upon you. But I think in the long run, it becomes also your story.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Elements of someone's life, it's sort of like no good deed goes unpunished. You know, you invite somebody in because you could see they needed a house and so forth, mm-hmm. and this thing happens because how could you know? How could you know? How could you have seen ahead of time? Mm-hmm. You were just acting out of the instinctual, intuitive generosities and assessments of someone's life, beautiful little boy. And our daughter took pictures of that little boy. And then this news happens, and everything that is familiar in that house is suddenly unfamiliar for a short period of time.
Right, and you chose to stay in the house for a while.
You had to reclaim it.
Yeah.
I mean, in talking to Susan Stamberg on the radio, I remember I said, you know, my neighbor David Mamet came over and he said, well, there's a Jewish proverb. And the Jewish proverb is, when you're walking down the road and you look ahead and you see a house on fire, a good person doesn't want it to be someone else's house. And that's a complicated mm-hmm. feeling because at the same time, you don't want it to be your house. Mm-hmm. So how do you proceed? Well, we were not going to let someone else's demons chase us out, but at the same time, when we sold that house, there was a big weight lifted off us, mm-hmm. to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's just hard to fathom the action itself, you know, that taking of a young, beautiful life,
right.
by any means,
right.
Especially when the person knew in advance, well in advance, that she had these inclinations. That's something that takes a lot of thought and a lot of conversations.
Yeah.
Therapy to some extent.
Yeah.
The various possibilities of approaching one incident from as many angles as you can, some charitable and some not so charitable.
Right.
And you certainly come to knowledge of yourself in very intense ways when that kind of thing happens.
Mm-hmm. And another part of the book that I so admired was your honesty in writing about both the charitable and the uncharitable feelings that you might have had, you know, at this time.
Yes.
You know, I mean...
Yeah. That took a lot of discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this might be a good opportunity for us to turn back to the importance of birds in your life.
Yeah, sure.
May I read a short section from the book?
Of course,
book?
Please.
It's just a little paragraph. Okay.
Oh.
I noticed that the kingfisher on the western shore, whose perch was a craggy branch of an old lightning-struck maple, was not sitting upright like an exclamation point, which would be normal. Instead, it wobbled, tucked itself between trunk and branch as if to gain balance, before tentatively venturing out along the length of the branch to resume its scrutiny of the pond. Something was a little off there. So I chose that because you write about so many types of birds in this book, and many of them are not sick. But I chose that one because even when you're writing about a sick bird, the prose is just so lovely and clear.
Oh, thank you.
And visual.
Thank you.
And it's so clear that you get great joy and almost like they almost take on a spiritual significance. Is that overstating?
Not at all. I mean, really, if anything in my life has a spiritual element.
Yeah.
Because I'd be very loath to use that term too conveniently or too easily.
Right.
It would be birds, and especially shorebirds. But the carefulness of language, I think, is a lifelong compensation for not being able to paint them. You know how they say somebody has a painterly way of writing?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I wrote a book called The Bird Artist. I mean, I live vicariously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I have been writing lately something that I call privately, and it might seem, I don't know, lofty or I don't know what I would call it, a kind of theology of birds. And what I mean by that is what emotions are drawn into focus in places like Point Reyes, where all those marvelous shorebirds are. You know, I was in Japan a few years ago, and I got to retrace Basho's journey on foot for National Geographic. And I was so happy because the Buddhist monks I would meet and stay with mm-hmm. were very open about their emotions about animals, especially about birds. And boy, I felt right at home with that.
Yeah.
There doesn't have to be a dogmatic or even traditional theological framework. It's just trying to describe what you can think about when you're in those areas that you don't think about at any other time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would call theological.
Yeah.
A kind of inquiry into what your true nature is.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Just if you can just add one more thing, I wonder if you can offer advice for writers who do find solace in the natural world and want to channel that into their work, if there's any advice that you have.
I think advice is really dangerous to give, but I would say one thing. Go to a lot of places you don't write about. Because I think if you go with a predisposition to try to describe it, you're only going to describe your predisposition to some extent.
Oh, good.
And you know, like, just go to a lot of places and don't write about it.
Yeah.
Or write about it after there's a kind of a displacement of the imagination. You know, you go to a place, you watch, you listen, you take it all in. Go to another place, displace your imagination back there and write about it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that can be useful. But again, I can only speak for myself in that. I think giving advice is not something I'm very good at.
But that's good. That's a unique piece of advice I haven't heard before, and I like it. So thank you. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really
oh, my pleasure.
It.
It's good to see you.
And thank you for tuning into Catalyst, RETN's program about people, ideas, issues, and the conversations around them. My guest today has been Vermont author Howard Norman, and his new book is called I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place. From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Howard Norman. You can learn more about his work at his page on his publisher's website, hmhbooks.com, and search for his name. Howard Norman's memoir, I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place, begins with a sentence about how, in the summer of 64, he used to sit on his basement steps, reading a book and trying to stay cool. You heard him read the actual sentence during our interview. It's a wonderful way to open the book, that specific action and image, complete with an insinuation about the weather and the different temperature downstairs. The scene does not disappoint, but goes on to offer more action and imagery from his 15-year-old memories.
So this week's Write the Book prompt is to remember when you were 15 and write a sentence worthy of opening into a larger recollection, if not a memoir. From that time in your life, be specific, imply some activity or impending action, and see if you can't involve one or two of the senses in some way as well. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I'm afraid I don't have time for the Bookworm's calendar this week, but I will bring it back soon. I've been closing out the show with thoughts about the pandemic. Things do seem to be getting better, knock wood, but, you know, we're still in it. So I'm encouraging you to wear a mask, to be safe, and also to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs, following their virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. For all of you who are trying to write, as I say every week, be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you've got any certain authors that you would like me to interview, or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Every once in a while, I like to explain that website. It's just a mnemonic for spelling my name. She Laughs Without Us means she laughs without the U and the S, which spells Shayla. Anyway, if you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.